Welcome to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates, where we believe that advocacy is the answer. Hey, everybody, this is Angela Orkin. Today's podcast is another conversation that we had during the NACC conference in Anaheim. In this episode, we speak with Leslie Heimov, Executive Director of the Children's Law Center of California. CLC is the largest children's legal services organization in the country, representing at any given time around 33,000 kids. They use a multidisciplinary model of representation with social work investigators and other specialized professionals. In part one of this conversation, we talk with Leslie about caseloads, innovative practices, and working with parents, attorneys, and the system to keep kids in their homes. We hope you enjoy this conversation with Leslie Heimov. We're here at NACC, and I think one of the things that everybody really enjoys hearing about, too, is what workload is like for attorneys. I know you've got you've come a long way in your office. Maybe you could just share kind of where you were and where you are and caseloads, that type of thing.
Sure. So caseloads are an ever-moving target. When I started, which was almost the very beginning, we opened in 1990. I started in February of 92. And I had about 350 cases, which was not clients, it was cases. So I don't know how many clients, honestly. We didn't keep track of it that way at the time, but I would guess it was around 500. We have worked very hard ever since to reduce caseloads. And in the past 6 years in particular, have done a lot of work at the budget, at the state level with regard to budget. So working to increase funding in order to reduce caseloads. And right now, the expectation is about 160 clients, no more than 160 clients per attorney. So that's a maximum recommended amount. But that assumes that the attorney is working with an investigator or other social work type professionals who collaborate with them. The current expectation in California is if the attorney is working solo, no more than 77 clients. But I don't know of anybody that has only 77 clients.
Right.
One other thing about caseloads,
yes.
If I may.
Yes.
So the other, while that has been happening and we've been working to reduce the caseload for a traditional attorney, we also have quite a few special projects now where we have dramatically smaller caseloads. So, for example, our crossover clients are served in large part by what are called our care teams, where there are an array of professionals who are working together on very small caseloads, 25 clients per attorney, with all of these other professionals working alongside them. And same with our children who've been trafficked. We have a 5-person CSEC team. 6-person, we just added another attorney, I'm sorry. We have a 6-person CSEC team where it's 3 attorneys, 2 case managers, and a survivor advocate serving about 180 girls, mostly girls. So it's very different ratios, and we would love for that to be the model for every child, but we're sort of starting with our most high-need, labor-intensive cases or clients to pilot that type of an approach and hope to someday get there for everybody.
As you were talking about that, one of the practical questions I had is, when you do pilots, do you typically seek a new funding source, or do you reallocate within your contract? How does that work?
So it's a little of both.
Okay.
We typically start very small within existing funding. So, for example, the first care team, which was for crossover kids, was 1 attorney, 1 investigator supervisor, and 3 MSW interns from a local university serving about 15 children. So we tried it out so that we'd have something to show to future funders, but then seek private funding, foundation funding to really expand it and develop the model, and then work toward integrating it into our long-term budget. So the CARE project, for example, has been funded. We're now in the second 3-year grant from the Hilton Foundation, which has enabled us to expand it significantly. And now with the increased state funding and the 4E funds coming in, we're ready to create more care teams throughout the organization that would be built into our state budget.
That is really exciting. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit. One of the topics that we at True North feel strongly about, and I think that you do too, is the need for parents and kids attorneys to be on the same page whenever possible. And so I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that, and then hopefully we can get to some practical things that an attorney out in the field can do to promote that.
So, yes, the LC definitely agrees. Our philosophy is the same as yours here at True North with regard to our role, and we believe, and the code tells us, right? Federal law and state law tells us that our job is to maintain family integrity whenever possible. And if we can't keep the child with the family at the very beginning of the case, that our goal should be return home, right? To safely return home in every circumstance. Obviously, that is not what always happens. And I think we have lots and lots of data now that is showing us that many systems, if not all, probably all, but I don't know that for a fact, around our country don't operate that way, right? We remove first and then figure out what to do. We separate first and then sit down and have a conversation about how we can put the family back together again, when really what we should be doing is figuring out how we can keep the family together and only separate the child from their family if there is absolutely no other option. And that brings, and that no other option, so you'd say, well, we have that. It's called reasonable efforts. But in our experience, reasonable efforts, as the social worker writes in the report, that there's a whole bunch of services that were considered but not provided because they weren't available, or there was a waiting list, or the family wasn't amenable. Well, that's not doing everything that you can do, right? No. So a lot of what we would like to see has to do with just following the current law and with oversight and accountability and implementation. So what do we do to try to instill that in our staff? So a big part of our training is about the importance of children staying with their family, and about looking at the impact of removal and separation the same way we look at the impact of a broken arm or a bruise, right? Which is hard to do, because what the judge is seeing is, if I leave this child in the home, their parents might hurt them or their parents might neglect them, and they would have this injury that I can see. But we don't have a way to see in the present the injury created by the time spent in foster care. I don't know how we get there, but that's the goal, right? To be able to have a picture of what the separation is doing as a form of abuse or neglect.
Really like that way of thinking.
I do too.
That's perspective altering, and I think that...
But for me, like let's say I'm the judge. I can see these judges going, you know what? This is too, it's too scary, because I have had those cases where, you know, I've let the person, the child stay home and they've died.
Right.
And so how do you get around that with them?
I don't have the answer yet, but I think we keep hitting it. We look to research. We bring that research to the forefront. Hearing from youth is always impactful. I mean, we have adults now who are professionals who are working in the system. We heard from one this morning. We heard from several this morning in the keynote that can talk to us about what that felt like for them when they were growing up. And we have current clients who can talk about what that feels like. And it's a culture shift. It's not going to be, here's the answer to that question. And as we start seeing more successful situations of families that are kept together, when we can come into court or through training, show, okay, there was 300 kids who could have been detained but who were left at home with XYZ services, and they are now thriving, and we close their case in 9 months instead of in 5 years, that is what it will take for the system. I think on an individual case basis, though, it's the attorneys, have to just step back and breathe and think about it and make that argument. And the organizations have to support their people. My staff have to know that if they argue for a child to be returned back home at detention and something goes awry, as long as they made their best judgment in the moment with the information that they had, that our organization is going to support that. So there's that piece, too, that the staff have to know that their upper management is going to have their
supporting
back.
Them. But you said it's a culture change, mm-hmm. and you were a policy person, or you did a lot of the policy work at CLC at the beginning. When I first met you, actually inspired me to do that in Florida. But so I'm going to guess that you probably have an idea in your mind how you want to move or shift this culture. Are you willing to share that?
I can think about it and try to share it. So I think there's so many different pieces. For example, when one wants to introduce bringing children to court in their system and they have judges and others that are afraid to have kids in the courtroom, the first child you bring to the courtroom needs to be one who's going to be articulate and thoughtful and calm and is doing really well currently in their life. You don't bring a child to court who's going to fall apart. That's the first child you bring into a courtroom. Your judge is never going to let you bring another one. So you have to be strategic about this. Of course, we want every youth to have that opportunity and to be present for their cases. So similarly on this, if we start with things like, what does the parent's contact with the child look like at the very beginning of the case? The default in most cases is monitor visitation. There are many parents who maybe, who just because they can't or the court doesn't believe that they can safely parent 24/7, doesn't mean they can't go to the park for an hour, right? And yeah. So if we have a parent who's struggling, but they're not, maybe it's an issue of discipline gone awry. Again, so they come to the foster home, they visit in the foster home for an hour, visit's going well, everybody's enjoying, they walk down the street and get, you know, go to 7-Eleven and get a icy and then come back to the foster home and nothing bad happened. And they're not going to run around the corner and beat the child when nobody's looking. That's not the way it works when it's a situation of discipline gone awry.
Right.
Or a parent who's struggling with addiction but is a loving and caring parent, as long as they show up for the visit clean and sober, why do they have to be monitored and supervised, especially if they've been raising this child for 2 or 3 or 5 years? So there's ways that we can introduce the system to more normal and naturalized contact between the child and the family as we work toward not separating at all. And then on a parallel track, we have to have more robust systems, right? More services that are available on demand immediately at no cost to the parent. I don't know if either of you were at the ABA conference in April, but on the parent conference, not the child's conference,
No, there
was an amazing presentation from Canada of a program where pregnant women can come to this medical program. They live at the facility, it's run by a doctor, and it's harm reduction to the nth degree. They can still use while they're pregnant, and they're doing drugs, heroin, meth, crack, whatever it is, but they're getting proper nutrition, they're getting prenatal care, and it's in a supervised setting. And of course the goal is for them to stop using, and they're in this supportive environment where they have a clean place to sleep. And they had, as I said, I mean, nutrition was the big thing that the doctor was really, really focused on, and prenatal care. And then they have a healthy baby instead of a baby that's struggling. And they continue to live there after the baby's born for as long as they need to. And their success rates are phenomenal.
That is so crazy to hear, though, because you think the science is that you can't use, drink, anything while you're pregnant. And you're saying that this is fostered.
Well, I think... not being a scientist,
right,
or a doctor.
Yeah.
The goal is to stop using, and most of the women do stop using. But if they come to a program and the program says you have to stop using today, they leave. So they're definitely using now, and they don't have prenatal care, and they don't have good nutrition, and
all
maybe they're engaging in even more risky and dangerous behaviors to get their drugs or to have a place to sleep.
So they're in treatment, but they don't have to be perfect.
Right.
Right.
And
so
they don't even have to promise to stop today. And they literally can shoot up in the program.
Wow.
But and they've been doing this for 20 years. So I'm kind of going on a tangent. So back to parents and kids, family, parents, attorneys, and children's attorneys working together and being on the same page. From my perspective, the child's attorney should be the parent's attorney's best friend, because nobody can do more for them to help promote the parent's goals than the child's attorney. Because when we're aligned, and we both go into court and say, this is the plan, this is the safety plan, these are the services that are being put in place, and then the child's attorney is saying, I want my client to be returned to the parent or to stay with the parent, my client wants to be there, and I'm in agreement with this plan. That's how we serve families, and that's how we reunify families. Yesterday at the Children's Office Project workshop, everyone went around the table and said why they were there, and every single person said, because I want to provide better services for children. I want to provide better services for families. And that was what I said, is I'm here so we can do a better job for families. Children
That's
are
perfect.
Part of a family.
Yes.
And we shouldn't be viewed as I'm here for the child and you're here for the parent. We are all here for the family. I'm not saying we're going to agree 100% of the time, but those are the ends, right? The ends of the bell curve. Most cases are not extraordinary. Most cases need some pretty simple interventions, and kids need to go home and be with their families or stay with their families.
So how does it work in LA? I mean, I know we're kind of on a tangent, but not. But so with that, most cases need services. Are you able to get traction with that with the child welfare agency here and with the judges, or do you get pushback on that? That, you know, we're going to keep the child in foster care pending the services, or how does that go?
We're not there yet. I think at the management level, everyone agrees. The director of children of DCFS, his executive team, his management team, we all agree we want kids to be at home. The rub is what's enough, what's safe enough, what's good enough, right? And we don't have consensus yet, and it's definitely case by case and judge by judge, and some judges are much more willing to make what seems like the tougher call. And that goes back to me, though, to the trauma thing. The tougher call should be separation. The tougher call shouldn't be going home. That should be the easier call, because that's where we want children to be.
Are you educating in any way the judges, or do you somehow... I mean, I would think it would have to take more than a case-by-case thing. Is there some sort of county meeting or what?
There are so many work groups and so many meetings.
I imagine, and we have
an annual conference. We have an LA conference. We have a statewide conference. The statewide conference is every other year. It's called Beyond the Bench. We have something called the Partnership Conference in Los Angeles. There's Judges College. So there's a lot of training that's always going on. The other end of that problem, though, is we also have a very high turnover with dependency judges. So those who are less experienced or have less time on the bench don't have the benefit of all of the training and experiences. And so that's a constant challenge of retraining. We have 28 full-time courtrooms, meaning 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. You know, all day, every day, doing nothing but a dependency docket in Los Angeles. We have 6 in Sacramento that are also full-time courtrooms. In LA, we detain, there's about 150 new filings every day.
Wow.
So the volume...
That was the state of Florida when I was there. That was the entire...
Right.
Yeah, the state of Florida was about...
150?
It was 32,000 kids, which is about where... So it had to be about that.
That's always been an interesting thing, is that Los Angeles County and the state of Florida... basically the same size in terms of child welfare population. So it's always a work in progress, and just training. And alongside of all of this, there's all the training that we are doing as a county and as an organization around cultural understanding and reducing, eliminating disparity and disproportionality, because that's all part of this too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's so many layers and there's so many levels at which we need to be constantly re-examining what we're doing and our work and our positions. But I think going back to keeping families together and parents and children's attorneys being on the same page, once the child is removed, the mountain is so much steeper, right? Mm-hmm. It's such a heavier lift. So until we can stop removing at all, it will be a constant uphill battle.
Yeah.
And that's the part where I think the most work needs to be done, and hopefully Family First will help with that, and hopefully continuing awareness and training. I think one of the programs in LA County that has been successful, there's only two offices that are part of a pilot working with cultural brokers and doing front-end family finding, and they are having excellent success preventing removal completely or having the removal be to a relative.
So that concludes part one of this episode. Please stay tuned for part two. You've been listening to the Children's Law Podcast, brought to you by True North Child Advocates. Please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word. Thank you.